Hello, and welcome to the 11th episode of the McMaster Communications Governance Observatory podcast. My name is Samantha Naidu, and this episode is the second part of the Bill C-10 discussion. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Fenwick McKelvey, an associate professor of communications at Concordia University. Dr. McKelvey is an expert in algorithmic media and is the director of the Algorithmic Media Observatory and co-director of the Media History Research Center. He has assisted the Canadian Internet Research Authority in the launch of its Internet Performance Test and is also the author of the book Internet Demons. Thank you so much to Dr. McKelvey for agreeing to be on the episode today. So Dr. McKelvey, could you please tell us a little bit more about the purpose of Bill C-10?
So C-10 is a reform to the Broadcasting Act, and it's one of a variety of proposals on the legislative agenda for the present government. And C-10 is the culmination of almost a five-year process, but beginning really directly in 2018 with the striking of a committee that was responsible for reviewing Canada's Broadcasting Act and Telecommunications Act. And this was known as the Broadcasting and Telecommunications Legislation Review. And so the BTLR, the Butler, or the Yale Report put forward in 2020 a series of recommendations about how the Broadcasting and the Telecommunications Act, as well as other aspects of Canada's, broadly speaking, system of communication governance should be reformed. And what the government has moved forward on, principally, is reform of the Broadcasting Act, and that reform is C-10.
Okay, thank you. And I've heard that part of Bill C-10 has this mandated financial contribution to Canadian content built into it. So I was curious to hear your thoughts on maybe the concept of a mandated financial contribution to Canadian content and how that intersects with Bill C-10.
So for a long time, how film and television has worked, particularly television, is that carriers, or what they call broadcasting distribution units, or BDUs, are responsible for giving back or contributing to production funds. And so this is a general system in Canadian cultural policy, which is that if you are, you know, distributing content and if you are potentially creating content, you should be contributing funds back to a common pool for creators. And this has been, I think, a really important feature of the Canadian system and the idea that we have subsidies and support for Canadian cultural production and cultural production in general. I think really to kind of push at questions about the efficacy of the market. And so the idea of C-10 in part is to expand the ability of the CRTC and the Canadian government to collect revenue from certain platforms or certain streaming services to contribute back to these funds. And this has been something which has been a very difficult problem for years. And so this is really laying it out quick. You know, clearly there's an expectation they should contribute back.
Okay, thank you. And then I've heard, so that's kind of the financial part of it. There's also a discoverability part of it. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to what discoverability is and how it fits in with Bill C-10 in regards to Canadian content.
Yeah, and to be clear, I haven't looked at the final bill. And so I want to say a lot of this has changed as it's been through committee. And it's been a bit of a roller coaster about following C-10. And I think one thing it's important is trying to point out, you know, what are these aspects of the bill, and particularly to me, this strange moment of how important discoverability came. And my introduction to this term discoverability came in around 2015 when the CRTC released the Let's Talk TV. Now, I could have my date wrong there, but basically the CRTC did this really fulsome consultation about how they're going to reform Canada's broadcasting system, thinking about what channels and dealing with these very kind of interesting nuances about how the broadcasting system worked, what channels had access, what were the contributions of this idea of having skinny basics. So it's a really big blockbuster decision. And in that, they emphasized this term called discoverability. And discoverability was something that they meant how Canadians accessed content. And a lot of it, and this is something that is an interesting part for me, is that I really seized onto and was very interested in this concept of discoverability, because I felt as though it was a useful term for describing a power that websites and media platforms had in changing how people engage with content. And so myself and Rob Hunt, we wrote a series of papers talking through and thinking through this idea of discoverability as a specific limited form of media power that we would want to pay attention to. So thinking about how platforms arrange their screens and so what prominence are given. So basically, you know, and this came about really back in the day when Netflix was transitioning from being a, you know, a kind of like a Blockbuster store where they had all sorts of different movies to being something more like their own streaming service with their own shows, which was a shift. But, you know, back in the day, it was interesting because we were looking at the Netflix screen and the screen changed so that more and more the biggest thing on the screen was a promotion of Netflix shows. Mm-hmm. And that this term discoverability, I basically after the decision, I'm jumping around a little bit, but basically after the decision in 2016, there was a conference called the Discoverability Summit where they're bringing people together to talk about this question of discoverability in this fulsome sense of the term. And I remember sitting at a workshop with an advertiser talking about how they sold advertising on your television. So if you have a smart TV, very often at the bottom now, there's like a little ad or something. So I think I have a Samsung, and the Samsung always has an ad when I like load up my option. And they would call that as an advertiser a first impression unit. And so Netflix doesn't sell access to the home screen, but other companies do. And so this was something what we were trying to point out is that there's an entire system of advertising and marketing that goes into how platforms are presenting content. And then what algorithms or what are the pathways through the site that are recommending content? So this came up after that, seeing this discussion, we put forward this discoverability paper. And to me, that's still, I think, a really useful, important term. What's come up now is that discoverability has really narrowed in the C10 discussion. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of the emphasis, which has always been concurrent, is with the idea of discoverability of Canadian content. And so how do you increase the prominence of Canadian content on screens? And I think to me, that's where it gets into a bit of a frustration because it's not entirely clear that that is going to work. So the idea that you're going to fix this prominence is going to have this effect people are making out to be. There's not a lot of evidence or research. It's a really challenging, vexing problem to do discoverability research. Mm-hmm. And that it also, if you're just focusing on discoverability in Canadian content, you're really ignoring a lot of issues, I think, about vertical integration and power and the fact that some of these systems, like particularly Spotify's discovery mode, seem like this new form of payola, which is kind of questionable. And I think that, you know, there is a possibility in C10 that it will go there, but I look at it and I'm like, well, that's a big challenge. But all I say is this is this big context and C10 is talking about increasing the discoverability of Canadian content.
Interesting. And I'm curious, do you know what evidence the bill was drafted on, if it's really evidence-based, or if an advisory group came together, or really what that process was like?
Well, it's interesting because discoverability also came up through the work of the Canadian Media Fund, and the CMF did a few reports on discoverability, which included some research. And the Yale report or the Butler report also talks about discoverability and the potential influence of that. I would say the level of evidence and research isn't to the degree that we have a good sense of what that influence is. I have some anecdotal insights. YouTube, for example, says that 70% of watch time on its site comes from the content it's recommending. Arguably, though, if you look at, you know, the own CMF's research and the media technology monitor, word of mouth and conversations are much more influential. So, you know, I think that it's important to say that discoverability might have a kind of marginal influence, which is still important. And it's not to belay regulation. In fact, I think regulation is important, but it's not necessarily going to be the fix for if you're concerned about the prominence or accessibility of the future of Canadian content, tweaking the algorithm, I don't know will have the effects that people are seeking.
Okay. And this follow-up is a bit of a big question, but how would you kind of promote Canadian content and have that effect of having it, I guess, more in people's ears or more in people's eyes, more in people's view?
Well, I always look back and I think one of the parts that I felt as though when I was working discoverability, I was playing around with the relations between, say, internet regulation or broadcasting regulation. And I was much more tentative, but I was certainly toying with that. And it's really, I think, struck me as a surprise how much broadcasting is really just being applied as a solution to the many of these internet problems. Mm. And so I'm saying this is all my qualification, because I'm basically saying that, you know, I don't think that broadcasting policy has a wide application to the internet, but I think it might have specific applications. You know, when we talked about a broadcasting system, the broadcasting system in Canada included these questions of mandatory carriage, so that these are the certain channels and packages you needed to have. And so I think, for example, like APTN was often, you know, considered mandatory carriage, so it would be appearing up in your cable package. And if you're thinking about the new C10 trying to ensure that there's a, you know, Indigenous content in Canada's broadcasting system, you can think about how those kind of mesh. So in one sense, we've addressed these problems through technical measures in the past. There would also be, you know, questions of like what content you could display at what times. And this was something that was worked out largely through kind of industry-led or co-regulation, but you'd have something like the watershed hour, where you try not to have like really scary content because children might be watching between a certain period of time. And so I say that, you know, when we start thinking about the broadcasting in the past, we might think that we arrange this technical system and we built in certain policy objectives within that system. And those policy objectives included, you know, kind of some technical measures like, well, this needs to be ensured. How does that translate to the internet, right? How would you think about that same type of work? It's challenging to me because the two biggest breaks are, you know, one is just a lack of data. And there's this real question about, you know, what are we watching? What are people consuming? And the fact that the very access to some of the metrics and analytics that these companies hold, it is often confidential. And so one part is like, it's really hard to speak knowledgeably about this because you're really only picking apart these different pieces. I mean, Netflix only started releasing, you know, some limited amounts of its user data a couple of years ago. So, and the other part is that a lot of these algorithms work by personalizing content. So the idea is that it's recommending personalized content. No, I think that's a bit of an albatross because, you know, for something like Netflix, there's all this other work trying to recommend the kind of like Netflix newest, latest show for you. But personalization, I think, speaks to a term that I think is important called optimization. So what are the types of behaviors that algorithms and platforms are optimizing for? And to me, if you were thinking about how would we want to go forward in terms of thinking about algorithmic accountability and thinking about how to, you know, potentially develop cultural policy for algorithms, the first step would be a fulsome understanding of what behaviors and what activities platforms are optimizing for, and thinking about what times that things are a technical decision. So this is like most personalized versus, I think, what we see in Spotify's discovery mode and other of these questions, but at one might be attempts at monetization. So the fact that they're using these systems as forms of advertising and, you know, promoting new shows, or if those things those deals are being brokered, you know, how do we learn about that? So that, I think, and then the part of that then would be emphasizing that we could put forward potentially different optimization goals. And so the Department of Heritage is part of a multi-stakeholder group talking about content diversity of content. And maybe it's ensuring that people are exposed to a wider variety of views. Mm. And it's hard to say, but there was arguably a time when YouTube was really trying to focus on kind of recommending the same type of content and kind of rabbit holing people. That's arguably changed, and they've tried to offset that. So it was a moment, but you could say that maybe that would become a goal. And to me, it's like the last part of this is that, and the most vexing one for me is that I would love to see mechanisms like how we've had discussions at the CRTC talking about maybe setting optimization goals or talking through. And I think that that's a really important way of how do you build in democratic institutions to bring greater accountability to some of the behaviors of these media systems. And that to me is such a tremendously important and challenging problem that I think that that's one of my, you know, concerns about C10 is it capable enough of addressing just how difficult that problem will be.
That actually leads really well into my next question, which is about auditing algorithms. The Yale report mentions that they think the CRTC should be auditing the algorithms. And I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on that and what you think that might actually look like.
The CRTC, I would say, already does this.
Okay.
And to me, how it does it bodes poorly for how it could do it with C10. And so I will make probably the listeners the strangest analogy ever, which is making a point that algorithmic accountability is a lot like internet measurement. And so if anybody has a home internet connection, the likelihood is that they've run like a speed test, which is to measure how fast their connection is. Now, speed testing is totally fraught and really difficult to do and really politicized. And I've spent years doing internet measurement, but it's something which is really, to me, and this is something I talk about in my book, Internet Demons, it's a form of algorithmic accountability. It's like, how are these systems, these algorithms behaving in the network? And can we see a little bit about how they work? And can that spark a conversation? The CRTC, for how it does internet measurement, is it delegates to a third party, Sam Knows, which produces the work. And Sam Knows is a great firm. And it releases it back to the CRTC. But it just gives back a report. So we don't have access to the raw data. It's questionable how well the CRTC can interpret some of that stuff, because there's been flaws in Sam Knows measurement that only after it was made public that people redacted, you know, or people, called into question. And, my own work, I've tried to put forward different types of testing methodology that have really been kind of controversial. So it's a challenge in the sense that evidence of trying to do algorithmic accountability, at least in internet measurement, I would say really as important as it is, hasn't advanced. You know, and I would point to the work of CIRA and Measurement Lab, who is, that's a personal choice, but it's also a professional one where it's like, I think that there's a real validity in that methodology. But that to me is, I think, an example of where, we're saying, well, we want to know how these technical systems work. How would we do it? And there's a whole work being done there. And yet, the CRTC's efforts in that, I think, have been, I would say, fairly lackluster. And then for other consultations, the CRTC has asked platforms to submit data in confidence. And so when we talk about algorithmic accountability, algorithmic auditing, there's been example, like what likely could happen is that the CRTC would just have all this data submitted in a confidence. And so if folks are hoping for some sort of transparency or oversight, it's a putting a lot of faith and trust in the CRTC to be able to interpret this and factor it into the decisions. And the last point is that myself and Reza Rajabhushan are involved in an important case at the CRTC involving Bell Canada's use of a machine learning system to filter spam and malicious calls at the transit level. So basically doing this call blocking. And taking aside, the utility of that program, a lot of what we've been asking for is that, can we get evidence of how this system works? Mm. Could we have evidence of something to do something like an algorithmic impact assessment? And right now we're pushing the CRTC to create and construct an algorithmic impact assessment. But that's been a result, at least in my own part, of trying to do 2 years of pushing at this. I think that's a really important connection. And I would hope that people would make the connection of that, it's Reza and myself and a few others that are really pushing for this. And yet, we're really hoping the CRTC will actually act on that. And if they don't act on that, then how are they going to do something which I think is even more complicated, which is do an algorithmic impact or an algorithmic audit of something like YouTube, which I keep up with the literature and it's not trivial to do. Mm-hmm. So that's where I think there's a real, really difficult question of doing algorithmic auditing well. And since the Discoverability Summit, we could have been building better federal infrastructure to tackle these problems. And, certainly there's been support and I've benefited from support of, Canadian Heritage to advance that. But I still think there's a long way off from where the CRTC is going to have the capability of doing that. And I think that that's not to say that they couldn't or shouldn't. It's just that I want to flag that and say that's something people need to take much more seriously than just adding a clause about an algorithmic audit. I wish there was some more details or some more direction or there's some more work in that area, because there is really good research there. But it's also hard and challenging. And I don't want to think that it's going to be as simple as we're going to tweak this algorithm and have the effect we want. I mean, often mm-hmm. we also see that algorithms behave in unpredictable ways. And that, I think, is something that, you know, is challenging. Yeah, I mean, I talk about this in chapter 7 of my book, Internet Demons, which is open access. Folks want to listen, you know, read it. But yeah, it's just a good example of, like, in the network neutrality file, there was attempts to throttle certain or slow down certain types of traffic, and it backfired and accidentally was, as far as we could tell, was also classifying games like World of Warcraft. And, you know, how do we also then embed in terms of algorithmic accountability, the fact that algorithms behave in ways that might not be expected? And how do we build in monitoring capabilities? And that's something, you know, ideally C10 would be showing a clear path forward towards that.
That's so interesting. I find this all so interesting because in medicine, you don't do anything without tons and tons of evidence. Guidelines need evidence to be created. And so, you know, I think it's so interesting because based on what you said, it sounds like doing research in communications is a bit of a different climate. It comes with its own set of challenges. And so I think it's interesting to hear the context in which this bill has been developed.
Well, I think that C10 to me, you know, really... And I think that's a great point, right? Like, where's the evidence here? And I think C10 should be understood within this kind of wider context of, well, there's reforms presently to the Copyright Act, potentially to journalism. There's apparently a bill looming that's going to address online harms and hate speech and harmful content online, which I think is an important, you know, bill if done right. And so I'm looking forward to that one. And then the Yale report, I would think, would also... be pointing towards reforms to the CRTC to make sure it has a better public interest mandate, which I think is really important. And, you know, my own work, I've also said maybe Measurement Canada should be more engaged in this. And I think that, you know, if there is a step towards addressing the broadcasting system, the first steps to me, and even in reading the Yale report, the first steps to me would be building systems for better evidence about what is happening on these platforms. And I think really fundamental questions like, what are the labor conditions? And there's some research been done about Ryerson and just about how poorly compensated a lot of online creators are. And I'm certainly would like to ensure that there's better labor rights there and better compensation, and that it's, and that being an online creator is a less precarious space, which you hear I was just reading a piece in Vox about TikTok burnout. And yeah, I mean, all these expectations. Yeah. I think it's a really hard place to grow up and to try to be able to think about you're going to make a career in media and what are your options there. And so, you know, one is like, how do we understand and collect data about what's happening there and those impacts in a more fulsome manner? And then how do we ensure, I think in some ways, that many of the participants that are part of the wider cultural sector are more engaged in the CRTC and in the rulemaking process, because I think the CRTC could certainly accommodate that. But I haven't, in my own experiences, seen the same degree of a diversity of participants as I would like to see. And I think that's something that we could really encourage, especially if you want to see the CRTC, as C10 is proposing, is being the forum for this. And I'm not opposed to that. I mean, I really, as much as I complain about the CRTC, I also love the institution. And I mean, I complain about it because I care about it. And I really want to see it, you know, fulfill the mandate of being a kind of direct or democratic institution that the people I think work there believe in. And I believe it too. And I want to see that. I want to see that pushed.
Okay, thank you. We will direct it a little bit back onto the C10 questions. So C10 has gotten a lot of pushback regarding freedom of speech and people thinking that it is censorship. So I was curious what your thoughts are on if Field C10 does affect freedom of speech.
Yeah, I think I was just taking a look. I know Blaine Haggard and Natasha Tukov have a piece in CG a bit about this, where they're, you know, kind of making the point, and I think it's a point made elsewhere, that, you know, we already have regulation of speech online. And that has two direct streams, right? You can talk about how community standards and social media platforms are addressing harmful and hateful content. Like, that's already being done. So if you're concerned about, you know, kind of this big tent term censorship, that censorship is already happening largely out of the public purview. Now, I'm not opposed to that censorship when it's coming to certain content. I certainly think I have lots of views on that that I'll kind of bracket. But, you know, I think we really need to have you know, a more fulsome conversation about the systemic racisms in Canada and the fact that that's part of what it means to be working as a media company in all areas, and how do we presence that. The other part is that, you know, what's being recommended, you know, and these curation decisions, which are also talked about as reach, that's the other, you know, part where platforms are making this decision. And what they say is that, well, we're going to make relevant content for you. We're going to recommend content you want to see. And so, I mean, that's an argument about, we think that people want to view content that they like already. And that's not potentially wrong, but that also is a form of policymaking, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So I think the first off is that often there's this, I think, attempt of saying, well, there's free speech online presently, and then we're going to oppose all this free speech. And I really kind of push back against that. And I think the other part is that when we're describing what C10 is attempting to regulate, I think it's left itself open to ambiguity because it hasn't, you know, because it doesn't have a social media exemption clause, or it doesn't, I think, even have a kind of a good fulsome understanding of trying to talk about this gray area, which is creators, which is like people trying to make a living off streaming Twitch, people mm-hmm. being YouTube celebrities. And that's a real industry. That's a Canadian media industry. And that part of it is where I think this freedom of expression thing is there. But there's also this side where this is about industrial policy and labor relations, right? And whether we have enough protections for online and cultural creators presently to ensure that those people who are working, and this is like following some of the work of David Niebuhr, in platformed cultural production are indeed protected. And mm-hmm. can the Canadian state do more to protect these platform creators? And that could be a place for C10 or something like C10 to address, say, concentration in digital markets. Mm-hmm. Like if you're trying to get access to, you know, an app store or selling your app, I mean, you know, you've got few choices. That, I think, has an aspect of cultural production that might warrant some attention. It's a stretch to say this is going to be well addressed necessarily by broadcasting, or this is a stretch to say this is going to be well addressed, like that C10 is going to do that. But so all I say is that, to go back to your question, is that people say that there's a free expression here for two reasons. One, because C10 leaves it kind of ambiguous about the scope of its regulation, which could have free expression implications, clearly. And that's one that I think we have to remain to see. But the fact that there is ambiguity speaks to some of the concerns with the bill, I think, very obviously. And that there's also, I think, an ambiguity about when we talk about creation and sharing online, you know, we're I think, still trying to find a balance between thinking about people expressing their views on Twitter and like the pressures and the kind of precarious job market that many people growing up now face, that are looking to the internet as both a place of free expression and a source of revenue.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that actually leads very well into the next question of what elements of Bill C-10 do you think actually add value to the regulatory process of social media platforms? And maybe as an aside, like, do you think the scope is too narrow right now, too broad right now, too vague? What do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, when I looked at the bill back in the day, I felt as though the bill, this is back last December, I think, and I have a piece in Policy Options where I'm talking about the, you know, basically saying create, it's a kind of unclear where creators are going to fit into this. Mm. And at the time, that included the exemption for social media companies. So without knowing the kind of scope of the final bill, the parts to say is that there is an argument that if you're concerned specifically about film and television, major streaming services platforms, which I think you could define as kind of over-the-top broadcasting service or video on demand services, have potential obligations to contribute and maybe prominence criteria, similar to what they're doing in the EU, but the Audiovisual Services Media Directive. I'm kind of mispronouncing that, but Dwayne Winsek has a good piece in CG talking about this. You know, there's a way that could be bounded. You know, if C10 is really about reforming broadcasting and trying to think about including new players in the broadcasting system better, you know, Spotify and a few of these others, it could do a better job of kind of stating that and stating a kind of threshold and to bring about reforms for film and you know, basically film, radio, and television, I think would be the three. And if that was bracketed off, I mean, that's fine, right? I mean, I don't know if that's going to address these issues of concentration, creators' rights, new culture, like basically the expansion of kind of cultural production, like the games and all these other different sectors, like podcasting. I mean, does podcasting fit into radio? But if you are trying to just do a modest update, then with some scaling back and ensuring that you're just talking about, you know, kind of streaming platforms in these kind of limited way, then C10 is fine. But I think to me, it doesn't address these questions of like, how are you going to do algorithmic accountability? How are you going to address kind of new cultural sectors like Twitch or YouTube stars, you know, or influencers and, you know, the kind of all these areas, and also concentration of digital markets. And to me, then, if it's not C10, I don't see where that's going to come about in the legislative agenda. And so I don't necessarily think C10 is the right bill to do it, but then it makes me more doubtful than that the attention should be given to C10, given these other sectors where there's potentially more need. And so that's the thing, my challenge is that C10 could have been written in a way that would be much less controversial and not hoisted up to be this fix for all these issues, where I think it has, like, a, you know, if constructed better, could be a, you know, a modest reform to, you know, the film, television, radio sectors. And I think, to me, that's so I have this kind of mixed feeling where I'm like the bill to be more focused, and so I'd like to be smaller, but then I'd also like it to be part of more of a broader discussion or conversation.
Yes, wow. I didn't even honestly think about the labor part of it, but you're right. Like, there's no protections in place right now. So you're right. I didn't even think about that, but it's a huge, huge area.
Well, research coming out of Ryerson has said that the average creator on YouTube makes about 20,000 Canadian a year, if I'm correct. So, you know, I think, you know, looking at whichever of the Paul brothers was fighting Floyd Mayweather on the weekend, you know, I think there's also like a real question about like what type of content is profitable and lucrative on these platforms. Mm. And I think in one sense, you know, I listen to, you know, I certainly think in my own life about how, you know, I'm more aware of Indigenous issues thanks to Indigenous Twitter. And I feel as though I have better access to journalists speaking from diverse points of view than I ever did. And so I think I really value and cherish that. And I want to see also people get paid better. And I think that's an issue well before the Broadcasting Act. But yeah, I think fair compensation for online creators is something that people talk about in terms of Spotify. I would also say it's a concern in journalism in general. And I would also say that has to do with, you know, what shows can make a living. And I think there'd be ways of, you know, restoring visions of public broadcasting and public service media that are more fulsome, you know, including better tools for creators to monetize their content that you know, that maybe have better user fees. You know, I think there's lots of interventions there that could be done, and I'd really welcome it. So to me, that's a part where I've read for years, just it's a hard place to make a living. And the ways you can make a living often are really confined and conscribed about, you know, being a certain, you know, vision. If you're talking about being a TikTok star, about, you know, like, especially for women, what does it mean? Like, you know, what type of bodies are profitable? And that, I think, is something that is part of cultural policy. And I want to see that better connected. And I think trying to encourage, you know, values that we've had in the broadcasting system before, like diversity of voices. And many of these companies are profitable, and creators are really concerned about times where they're being demonetized, or times when they might, you know, being shadow banned, or whether they're being recommended or not, you know, or their views suppressed. And I think all those real clear anxieties that creators have, I haven't found a clear voice in the policy circles in Canada. And the fact that they're not there, and they're not necessarily, I think, well addressed in this bill, you know, shows to me a long way we need to go for a vision of what cultural policy means in the 21st century.
No, for sure. And so I guess to end it all off, bringing it back a little bit to Bill C-10, is there anything that you think should be kept and anything that you think should be removed? And even if there's anything even that you'd like to add to it?
Well, I would like to see a definition of discoverability. And I haven't seen that well defined. And so I think that it kind of, if everyone wants to talk about it, I think behooves the bill to have a clear vision of what discoverability actually means. And then as the second point, I think that, you know, having a clear social media exemption, not in a way that takes accountability away, but tries to understand the complexity of trying to regulate these kind of new markets for creators. You know, if there's ways of kind of, you know, clarifying that so it doesn't apply as a fulsome application for social media content. I would also want to say the first things to me would be ensuring we have better monitoring. So like, what are the ways we could do the research here to have better evidence, as you suggested, and in reforms to the CRTC, you know, including a public interest, making it more transparent about the appointment of commissioners. I think also clear limits on what secret evidence can be presented. All those things would be the, so the first steps of me would be some maintenance on the CRTC, some better research, and then moving forward, if you're talking about C10, you know, reforms to, you know, what it means by discoverability. None of that's going to happen, it seems like. C10 is going to pass. And so it's weird making these recommendations knowing that, you know, who's listening. You know, the likelihood of any of this going forward is, it seems pretty limited at this point. And I think, you know, one of the greater disappointments is that discoverability, I think, is a really complicated term. And I really wish that it had given more thoughtful treatment and discussion. And I think that would be, you know, one part of, I think, a real direct frustration with C10 is that it's left that door of discoverability open, even though I think there was some really great work early on to kind of define it and trying to address that through the discoverability summit.
Okay, thank you so much. I learned a lot. You're very knowledgeable and wise and well-spoken and a really great teacher too. I feel like this is all explained at a level that I could understand as a complete novice. So thank you so much for your time today. And thank you to everyone for tuning in to this episode of the Communications Governance Observatory podcast. For more episodes, please visit us at cgo.humanities.mcmaster.ca. See you next time.